This is Helen Cannon with Petals and Prose, and I want to begin a series of conversations with you about roses. I'll begin with this quotation from a delightful book called Peacock Manure and Marigolds by Janet Gillespie. She begins, "One June day when I was young, single, and romantic, I had a flat tire on a road in France. It was a bicycle tire, and my friend and I, being typical females, trudged off on foot to hunt for a man, in capitals, to fix it. We went down a white dusty lane toward a clump of trees and a tower, and there, most appropriately, was an old chateau. The lawns had grown up to hay fields, the gardens were smothered, climbing roses ran wild over everything, filling the air with fragrance. The caretaker's wife appeared in an advanced state of pregnancy and asked us if we'd like to go inside. When we said yes, she produced an iron key and unlocked the great door. The hall beyond and all the visible rooms were in a state of indescribable chaos. Antique furniture, velvet drapes, gilt clocks, portraits, old clothes, garden tools were tumbled together in a hellish confusion, and over all was a snowstorm of letters. Letters, letters, letters. Some black-edged, some tied up with blue ribbon, some trampled in the dust. I picked up one written on crested paper, edged with black. The writing was angular and precise, the hand of a lady. It was not a letter. It was a list of old roses. I have the list by me now, since I took it away with me. The reason had something to do with the lady who wrote it. I saved a bit of her, perhaps. Later, we were shown the half-finished ballroom where roses tumbled through windows and arched over the room exactly like those in pictures of Sleeping Beauty's castle. What had happened? I didn't want to sound sentimental, although I am, but that list was my reason for growing roses. I didn't grow the hybrid teas and the hybrid perpetuals very long. I didn't like their bushes, but I grew them for what that unknown marquise or countess or whatever she was. Now, if there's one plant that is disease and insect prone, it's the rose, especially the hybrid teas. People will agree reluctantly that you may get along without spraying vegetables or even perennial borders, but roses, no. Since I took this book, messages arrive by word of mouth, all saying about the same thing. Tell Jan that if she thinks she can grow roses without spraying or dusting, she's crazy. I may be crazy, but I can grow some roses without spraying or dusting. I can grow, or one can grow, most roses with some spraying and dusting. You can grow some of the roses all of the time, all of the roses some of the time, but not all of the roses all of the time without dusting or spraying. This makes me think of a wonderful woman who lives in the valley and knows flowers and very, very well. Her name is Joan Shaw, and she lives in Lewiston, Utah, in what had been the first birthing home in the valley. If you look at Joan's online writings about different flowers, just if you consider her garden essays, her essays on roses alone come to about 19. I'll give you the titles of some of them. A New Rose Book for Your Shelf, Early Spring Roses, Roses in Sunset Colors, Miniature Rose Garden in Utah, Cascading Roses, Old White Roses, Pink Autumn in the Rockies Roses, Prolific Climbing Roses in the North, and it goes on and on. So her website, she calls her garden Dragon Goose Farm. And her website, you would look for under dragongoose.com. And I just wanted to read a little bit of Joan's writing about roses. The essay is called A New Rose Book for Your Shelf, A Rose by Any Name. The first serious rose book I read was one by the famous rosarian and writer Graham Stuart Thomas. I'd been collecting and planting old roses beginning in the 70s one of which was a favorite in the California nursery catalog, Roses of Yesterday. I started out with mostly cold hardy roses that could take frigid winters in far northern Utah. I treasured this and other catalogs of old roses that I'd found on the internet, not only for the plants they offered, but also for their helpful information on classification and cultivation. These catalogs led me to several rose dictionaries, such as the Ultimate Rose Book, a several-pound monster of a tome that rose enthusiasts with weak wrists would be smart to store on a library stand, as I do. And then, deciding to get serious, I sent for and read the above-mentioned The Graham Stewart Thomas Rose Book. One of the roses described in this book was a David Austin introduction, a climber that was his first attempt in the development of his English rose line. Having the characteristics of old roses with modern vigor and disease resistance, he named the introduction Constant Spry, honoring an English designer, decorator, writer, and lecturer who is credited with turning around the art of arranging flowers and gardens into an easy cottage style that is still current. Since the Thomas book moved into our home, like clothes hangers that seem to reproduce by themselves in closets, rose books have proliferated like dandelions along my shelves. In addition, I've found internet sites on roses through Google search. Often these old varieties are found roses cultivated from taking roses around abandoned houses and cemeteries. It seems that in the early 20th century, decorating followed the staid Edwardian style, extending even to flower arrangements in which anything other than stems of the same flower decorously arranged in vases was looked upon as vulgar. She goes on to tell about the York and the Lancaster, a fascinating history of roses, the York and Lancaster, describing the drawn-out wars of the roses starting in the 1400s. Here is the author's cogent description of those wars. After a spat between two of England's royal families about who deserved to wear the crown, the authors talk of the type of roses each wore on their standards. York's white, believed to be Alba sempiplena, and Lancaster's red, believing to be Rosa gallica. After these decade-long wars finally wound down, a truce was called and an emblem chosen by both sides as a symbol of their newly found amity, York and Lancaster rose. I wanted to read from another book dealing with some of these roses, A Natural History of the Senses by Diane Ackerman, and she too talks about the peace rose. The most popular hybrid tea in the world is a peace, a stunning multicolored pastel with sunset hues that shriek at noon and grow muted at sunset and record all the phantoms of light during the day. Its egg-shaped buds open into large pale yellow ruffles with the translucent tips that are often flushed with pink, and it smells like sugared leather dipped in honey. Of all my roses, the peace seems to have the most human complexion and human moods, depending on the moisture and the light of the day. An experimental rose, it was named on May 2nd, 1945, the day Berlin fell, and the Pacific Rose Society of Pasadena, because of this greatest new rose of our time, should be named the greatest desire, peace. Many presidents have had roses named after. Lincoln's is blood red. John Kennedy's is pure white. Another writer about flowers, wonderful writer, in her book, Green Thoughts, by an Hungarian writer, writes, peace has a romantic story. It was bred by the distinguished French house of Meilhan in 1939 when Francis Meilhan discovered in his nursery a ravishing rose growing from a single seed he had planted. He knew it had to be something extraordinary. The beginning of the war kept him from finding out exactly what. All he could do was to ship the unnamed, largely untested cuttings in all directions, hoping that one or another of them would safely arrive. These consigned to the American grower Robert Pyle in Pennsylvania were aboard the last plane to leave France in November 1940, a step ahead of the Nazi armies. Malans waited for 4 years to learn its fate until August 1944, when a letter arrived from Pyle. Quote, whilst dictating this letter, he wrote, my eyes fixed in fascinated admiration on a glorious rose, a pale gold, cream and ivory petals blended to lightly ruffled edge of a delicate carmine. There it is before me, full of promise. I am convinced it will be the greatest rose of the century. He was right. Peace was skillfully promoted. On the day Berlin fell, it was given its name in a ceremony in California, attended by rose lovers from all over the country, in which doves were set free. When the delegates to the San Francisco conference arrived in their hotel rooms, each found a vase containing a single specimen of the peace rose. So these histories of roses, I myself try to grow fragrant roses because I like to make potpourri. And so a lot of the new roses had the scent bred out of them in order to develop some other traits, such as resistance to different problems that roses are subject to. So I hope to talk with you more about roses and future Petals and Prose. Thank you for listening. This is Helen Cannon.
Programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members and the USU Extension 4-H and Youth Programs, assisting youth in acquiring knowledge, building character, and developing life skills in a learning environment. Information at utah4h.org.
The Zesty Garden is a production of Utah Public Radio with producer Shalane Smith-Needham and Brian Earle. To listen to past programs or get additional information about the show, just go to upr.org. If you have an idea for an interview, including guests or topics, send your suggestions to zestygarden@gmail.com. You're listening to Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1 Logan, KUSK HD1 Vernal, KUSL HD1 Richfield, KUST HD1 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1 91.5 Logan.